Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello and welcome back to a wild and wacky episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is Scott Weinberg. I am a veteran film critic, and I am joined by my good friend, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, who is a filmmaker and a doctor of astrophysics. Hello.
Hello.
How are you, Steve?
I'm good. I'm very excited to talk about these movies.
I know. We have discovered in recent episodes that when you and I disagree on a film, it makes for the best conversations. And I think we're going to cover that ground again this week, Steven. Why don't you tell our listeners the two films that we're going to be discussing in the realms of cinematic intelligence, I'll flip it, cinematic intelligence and scientific entertainment value.
So the theme of the week is ancient Egyptians being a cover for alien visitations, which is an idea that has a very long storied history that we'll get into. And so our matchup this week, that's the sort of common element between, no pun intended, between The Fifth Element and Stargate.
Two popular sci-fi films that are very different in most regards, but Steven pointed out to me as we were deciding, he said, I want to do Fifth Element. And I said, done, what, fine, you know, it's a popular film, and I definitely have some things to say about it, but what do we pair it up with? And he said Stargate, and we got some fairly good suggestions from Twitter, but none were better than Steven's suggestion of Stargate.
Well, quite a few of them were actually Stargate, so clearly we're not the only people to think of this.
Yeah. We're going to delve right into Luc Besson's The Fifth Element.
You know, I wanted to jump in and say also the reason why we chose Fifth Element, the reason why I said, hey, we should do Fifth Element next is partly because of the discussion that we had in the wake of the Flash Gordon Star Wars episode where you were talking about how much you love Flash Gordon and I was talking about how cheesy and terrible it is, in my opinion. and so we were talking about movies that I thought were cheesy and not terrible. And The Fifth Element is sort of the quintessential one of those for me. It's a movie that has all of the elements, really, in a way that Flash Gordon does, obviously 20 years later, 30 years later almost. But for some reason, I love this movie where Flash Gordon just didn't do it for me.
Okay. And now, see, I want everyone who listens to the conversation to follow to understand that if Steven were to say to me, I get all your complaints about this movie, but I feel precisely about The Fifth Element like you do about Flash Gordon, then that ends the conversation because it's not a win or lose debate. You know, it's an argument over like who likes what. And that means there's no right or wrong. It's just a fun debate to have. Having said that, and I am really glad that you like this movie, I hate The Fifth Element. I truly, truly do. I there are three things in this film I think are shine above the muck. It is the production design / special effects. You know, like yeah, the Jetsonscapes of all the cars and everything. I think that is as impressive as Besson and his technicians meant it to be. It still holds up today. The special effects in those exteriors is fantastic. It truly is.
Yeah.
And the production design, fascinating to look at. The interiors of the buildings and the costumes and the makeup.
The aliens.
Yeah, the aliens. Yep. The visual side of the film is impressive. I also think that of all the people given like free rein to do whatever they want in this movie, the only people who come off impressive are Gary Oldman and Mia Jovovich. I think everybody else, I mean, Bruce Willis, he looks so bored in this movie, man. He looks bored in a lot of movies, but he looks especially bored in this one. And this is not going to be an episode where you say what you like and I say no, and you say something else you like and I go, ugh. I would rather.
I think it might be.
No, because I'm just going to, you know, I mean, it'll be fun to run through it, but I want everyone to know that I'm not trying to like argue his opinion or prove him wrong as if I could. I'm not.
Yep.
I just, although we can both agree that Chris Tucker is at 14 on this movie when he should be at 9.
Well, I mean, we can agree that he's at 14. Whether he should be at 9 or not is a matter of opinion, and I would disagree.
I just think narratively, story-wise, I think that Besson is very interested in the scene that is on the screen. I think he is fascinated in what the actors are doing and the silly sound effects and how where he can put his camera and how each individual sequence can look fascinating. But as a cohesive narrative, this movie is just, it's like a car that won't turn over. It just like there's a prologue in Egypt. Then there's a prologue with a glob in space. Then we meet Corbin, the cab driver. Then there's like duck face robots. Then there's a guy putting a gun in Corbin's face, Bruce Willis's face. We don't know why. It pays off a little bit later because he's his scumbag neighbor. You can't understand half of the dialogue that some of the characters are saying. Not just Chris Tucker is indecipherable later in the film, but a lot of these side characters, I don't understand the words that are coming out of their mouth.
You sound like an old man.
Okay.
What are these kids doing with their fast movies and their MTV editing and their...
No, I don't think it's... I don't know. I'm not saying it's hypercut.
I can't understand a word they're saying. I had to turn my hearing aid up to 11.
No, I mean, I literally can't understand what they're saying. If I were to say, Steven, this movie is Vuvel Zhuzho Grzingzhong, you'd go, wait, what did you just say? And that's what I mean. It sounds like it doesn't, I don't mean the slang is weird. I mean, I don't understand half the syllables. Like, that's all.
Yeah. I mean, Let's do a quick synopsis of the movie.
It's about a cab driver, essentially a cab driver who a beautiful woman crash lands
air cab driver.
An air cab. Yep. He's a cab driver and a beautiful woman, kind of like Blade Runner in a way. Dayglow, Blade Runner. It has a dash of the film noir in which a beleaguered nobody, his world is invaded by crime or something exotic invades his mundane world, and he gets caught up in espionage and intrigue and violence and sexiness. And so it is a film noir in that way. But a film noir, again, that just there's no narrative drive forward. The first hour of this movie is sequences, not a story. I can't. It's aimless. That's what
See,
I mean.
I disagree entirely. Like,
go ahead. No, I want to hear your take on this. I want like the first hour of the film narratively.
Number one, I was thinking about sort of as I was thinking, like I read, an online synopsis of it, and it talks about like alien races from ancient Egypt and this woman who's the perfect being, and she gets, they recreate her from her DNA, and then she falls into Bruce Willis's thing, and then he has to go to space and retrieve these stones. And like the whole thing is on paper, especially like incredibly dense with jargon and alien names and all of this other kind of stuff. And yet for me personally, and again, I don't know however you feel about the narrative drive of the movie, I felt like everything was clear, like in terms of like knowing who's on what side, who's doing what for what reason. Like to me, all of that stuff, it was never confusing.
Everybody wants these stones, right? That's the MacGuffin, or that everybody wants these magical stones.
Yes.
All right.
And Zorg, played by
Gary Oldman,
is the bad guy who is in touch with the big bad guy. So the uber plot of this thing is that there's this evil force that appears in the universe once every X thousand years and tries to destroy everything. And then there's this race of robot ducks, as you called them, which is an apt description, that tries to stop him via the five elements. So point of science, let's get this out of the way right away. The fifth element is not love. The fifth element is boron. And there are a lot more than five. There's like 138 in now.
That's so great. There literally is a table where they're numbered.
Yeah. So the idea is there are five elements, the four elements that we sort of think of, their Aristotelian elements of earth, air, water, and fire, which Aristotle, who was wrong about pretty much literally everything about science.
Right, but he said it all convincingly.
Right, but he said it with such authoritativeness that everybody was just like, oh, well, he sounds like he must know what he's talking about, so that must be the right thing. So he said there were four elements, earth, air, water, and fire. There's the fifth element, which is referred to in the film. She's referred to, Mila Jovovich's character is referred to as the fifth element, but then sort of at the end we realize the fifth element is actually love. Which is cheesy as all get out, but...
it kind of goes hand in hand. And now, I don't like this film very much, but I'm still obviously going to give it a fair shake when we talk about, like, the thematic and the intent. It's a weird vibe that Luc Besson has given off here. Sometimes it's violent, sometimes it's ugly, and sometimes it's wacky, wacky comedy, and I don't think Luc Besson is very good at comedy. I think that's my main issue with this movie.
Well, I mean, if you don't find this stuff funny, then yeah, no, of course you're not going to like the movie.
I like a lot of his films. I do, and I even like some of his films that are kind of not liked. I like the one he did with De Niro, but
Well, so I walked into this movie with my favorite movie of all time at the time that I went to go see this in the theater was The Professional, which is could not possibly be any more different from this movie in terms of almost every element whatsoever, except for Gary Oldman. And so I walked into this kind of expecting something like that, or, you know, something by that same director. And
it just feels like an hour of aimless but beautiful looking film noir machinations, and then they get to the ship with Chris Tucker, and it finally has some action pulse to it, but there's no reason to pitch a character at like a tuning fork level where he is grating in your ears. And if he is, that character should be on screen for 30 seconds, not 30 minutes. And it's almost like the Willie Scott, Kate Capshaw in Indiana Jones. I don't want to spend any time with that movie character at all.
That's fair enough. Yeah. I think that you are not the target audience that he was going for. I mean, this movie, so, you know, the backstory of this is that he wrote it when he was 16 years old and tried for 20 years to get it made. And it feels like a movie made for 16-year-olds.
Right. It feels like a movie written by a 16-year-old and never rewritten by a 36-year-old.
I do not in any way disagree with that assessment of it.
Okay. All right.
I think that that is absolutely, you know, it is a movie, yes, that feels like it was written by a 16-year-old, but then made by a master filmmaker.
The duck face robots are the good guys, and the troll heads who hang with Zorg are the bad guys.
That alien design is pretty cool. Both of those alien designs are pretty cool.
Yes, it is. No, it is. I've said it, man. I mean, I don't think the plot or most of the characters are interesting, and the narrative does not hold my interest, but just as a visual spectacle, 5 stars. I mean, literally fantastic. And if that's all you're interested in, if you want to see a visual spectacle and you're nominally interested in a plot, then I give this movie a B+.
So I disagree. I don't think that that's a fair assessment of the movie to say that it doesn't have a plot. I think
I think it's disinterested in its plot. I think it's very disinterested in its own plot. But no, I don't want to cut you off. You go.
I don't agree. I mean, you know, we know from, you know, after this prologue, which is a very common filmic device, we have a prologue setting up the stakes, and setting up this world of the ducks and the five elements. And after that is over, the story is sort of, you know, we know exactly who the bad guy is right from almost frame one, because it's this giant thing that they're encountering in space. We are introduced to Mila Jovovich's character by minute, you know, 15.
Right. Now, yeah, explain, what is Lilu? What is her? She is brought back from an explosion. She is reconstituted from DNA.
Yes.
So what is, like, explain what she is. What is she in the realm?
Well, so this gets us into some of the science stuff, which is, I think, is good. Yeah, I mean, you know, she is the supreme being is what they keep referring to her as either perfect or as supreme being, which is, there's very little evidence of on display over the course of the movie that she is supreme in any way other than that she's gorgeous. She can learn things really, really fast by just watching TV a lot, Matrix style.
Johnny Five style, I think you mean.
Yes, Johnny Five. Well, this is, you know, it's also predates the Matrix. You know, it says that she has 200,000 base pairs of DNA as opposed to human beings, 400. I don't know what those numbers are supposed to represent, because human beings actually have something on the order of 3 billion base pairs of DNA. So her 200,000 would be considerably less than we have. I don't know, she might be, you know, a slime mold.
See, that's what I was trying to figure out, Steven. Is she like a god who doesn't realize she's a god yet? That's kind of what I got.
That's kind of the point. I don't know. It's very, I will admit that it's very confusing. And in this, you know, at the bottom of it, I think that part of the reason why this movie resonates with me in a way that it did not resonate with you is that when I was 20 years old, seeing a beautiful woman who was simultaneously very vulnerable and also very strong was a thing that I was primed, for reasons I won't get into, but for psychological reasons, to find. And I don't think it's just me. I think that
dude, you don't think it's just you. Luc Besson's first 4 movies are about young women. I mean,
okay,
you know.
Yeah. But maybe also why I like The Professional so much.
It's a natural instinct, you know. Steven, I think you nailed that's part of why the film is so still well remembered, and I think she is the heart and soul of the movie. She is great. I don't hate the movie. I just don't like it. But even if I hated it, she's worth watching.
Yeah, well, and if you feel like you want to protect her the way that Bruce Willis does, then like, then you're on board from that first scene of her in the cab where she's, you know, like, please don't let the police come in and take me. And he, you know, sees her vulnerability and decides to, you know, protect her. And that, again.
So germ of your love for this movie is her superlative performance. That's natural. That's beautiful. That's
and the production design and the visuals.
And it always makes me laugh when people would dismiss her as just like an action girl. Like, yeah, all right, maybe she's not Meryl Streep, but that woman can hold her own. She's not a bad actor at all.
No.
She just stars in a lot of silly action movies and monster movies, and God bless her. Nothing wrong with her.
Yeah, and I think she, for the character that was acquired for this movie. Now, we can get into some aspects of that that are, as the kids say, problematic, because I think that there is definitely a current of sexism, if not misogyny, running through a lot of that. And I will freely admit that at 20.
It's a patronizing thing. I think it's a very patronizing, like, you know, all his movies have to have like a semi-helpless waif who, you know, will slowly morph into the angel of death, you know, and it's like, all right, she has to be protected in the beginning, but she doesn't really. The man thinks she does.
Well, but then she, you know, in this movie, it's throughout. Then she has this vulnerability at the end as well, and it's his love for her that ends up being able to open up the fifth element and save the universe, which is a very sort of, you know, that's another trope that's very, very common in movies, especially in science fiction. You know, you see it in The Abyss. You see it in, I'm trying to think of some other movies where, like, something is going to destroy the Earth, and then they decide not to because love, or because humans have the capacity for love and compassion, and that means they're worth saving.
Yeah, that is a trope that goes way back, before even Twilight Zone, I think. What is Zorg's plan?
Zorg's plan is one of the biggest problems with this movie. Oh, so by the way, but talk about performances pitched at 14. Gary Oldman's Zorg is pitched pretty darn close to that. It is not a subtle performance in any way whatsoever.
Right.
Even
true.
By Gary Oldman standards, it's kind of over the top scenery chewing.
He looks kind of ridiculous. Yeah. I hate that hair thing. I mean, it's like, I get it. Exotic is cool and you want to be super futuristic, but man, you just look silly.
Yeah.
Chris Tucker looks silly too. These people are looking silly.
Yeah, but they're supposed to. So I don't disagree that they're silly. This is part of the reason why I wanted to cover this movie, is because I don't want to say accused, but somebody, you know, said that cheesy to them implies bad. And I was trying to argue that in the case of Flash Gordon, I didn't appreciate the cheese factor of it, but I didn't mean it as an epithet. And this to me is proof of that, because I think this movie is every bit as cheesy as Flash Gordon, if not more so.
Yeah, but I just think it's not. I think this goes from cheesy to like garish and borderline obnoxious. And you might feel that about Flash Gordon, but
I think part of the difference to me is, you know, Flash Gordon, as you said, on a visual level, on a special effects level, on a sort of mastery of the camera, the way the camera moves and all that kind of stuff, like, I think this movie is a far more accomplished film. If you didn't speak English and you just sort of watched any given scene from this movie, you'd think, holy crap, this director is like fantastic.
Yeah, I would think, wow, that is the most beautiful McDonald's ad I've ever seen right there. That is gorgeous, the way it's just lingering on that McDonald's ad.
But it doesn't feel cheap is my point. Like, there's certainly no part of this movie that feels cheap.
No.
All right, so let's talk about some science. So the first bit of science in the thing, like I said, is about this thing where they, you know, her ship gets blown up as she's coming to Earth to try to save the world. And the only thing that they're able to save is this glove, which has her hand in it. And so they, you know, do this DNA thing, and then this machine rebuilds her skeleton and rebuilds the muscles from her DNA. There are some obviously problemish elements with the fact that, you know, if you were rebuilt from your DNA, you would not have any memories. You would not have any, you know, you would basically be a baby again on a mental level. Like an infant, like a newborn. You wouldn't know how to walk. You wouldn't know how to, you know.
Would DNA sequencing create your original form? You know, if you had just my hand, would I come out looking like me, or could you make me look like Clooney when I came out?
No, I mean, if it was your DNA, you'd look like you. Presumably, you know, most of the time when we're talking about like cloning people, like you create a baby of them and then you make it grow bigger, right?
Right.
You know, and you might speed that up via technology or whatever, so it only takes 5 years instead of 20 years. But that's the sort of basic idea. Here, they actually take her DNA and they feed it into a computer, and her computer, I guess, figures out, okay, this is how she would look when she was about 19 years old. so we're just going to build her at this age. Of course,
I was just waiting. I was waiting for one of the doctors to be like, "Do we have this thing set on gorgeous?" Because
well, they keep referring to it as he before she gets built.
Yeah,
like,
they think
the
it's a guy.
Is the, they think it's a guy, but it's like if they have its complete DNA, then presumably they know that.
I want to throw one more thing in about Mila. Yes, obviously she is striking and gorgeous and really good with the ass kicking, and but I can only imagine how hard it is to emote a completely made up language and do it with some heart and some emotion.
Yeah.
And she is great at that. Yeah. I wouldn't even try. It would be embarrassing. I'd be embarrassed to try. For her to do like a phonetic alien language and she gets it across with her voice and her eyes, she's not just lovable. She's just a fascinating character. Yeah. I mean, I wish the movie were better around her.
So then they, you know, add her muscles and then they say, okay, well now we're going to bombard her. It's so alert. We're going to bombard her body with ultraviolet radiation. And that's going to cause her body to have a reaction where it will grow skin. No.
Wouldn't that grow tumors?
I mean, yeah, the part of the point of your skin is to protect you from the ultraviolet radiation.
All right.
So, well, like,
we can preface this whole conversation with, I don't think Luc Besson or any of his designers really cared about
the
accuracy of it. But it is fun to pick through it. So,
right.
Bombarding a shell with UV rays would what? It would grow tumors, right? Isn't that what it would do?
Yes. I mean,
it's poison.
Ultraviolet, yes, will cause your skin to grow cancer. I'd have to look it up to see. It certainly wouldn't just make you grow skin, flawless, perfect white skin. I mean, it is true that when you go out in the sun for an extended period of time, your skin reacts to that by creating more melanin and more pigment in your skin, which then acts as a protection from ultraviolet rays causing skin cancer and whatever else in your body. So there is some truth to the fact that your skin itself can react to ultraviolet in a biological way. I don't see that there's any reason to believe that if you built a person with just their musculature and then bombarded them with anything, that it would do anything other than just, you know, kill them. She's sitting there with her muscles hanging out and no skin, you know. But on the sort of comic book level of logic, okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's, you know, sure. That makes as much sense as anything else going on in this movie.
Oh, yeah. No. You know, I don't like the movie, but I'm not going to knock it for things that all the movies do, which is gamma rays and B12 and injection and sterilize. Go.
Right.
And now she's invisible. Got it. You know, like, just do it convincingly.
So then he says, activate thermal bandages. Like, her skin needs bandages because they just got bombarded with a bunch of UV rays, and so now she needs to be bandaged.
They thought she was going to be a guy, and yet they have a strategically placed lattice of bandages that cover her breasts.
Yeah, they cover her nipples, basically, and her nether regions, and very little else. It's like, okay, well, were they not expecting the rest of her body to be thermally damaged in any way?
Right, how about a towel? How about that? How about she's naked and you give her a towel? How about that?
So then she escapes and she manages to get out, which how could they not have been expecting? You know, they literally went on and on about how she's the perfect being and 20,000 pairs of DNA and yada, yada, yada. And then they create her and they think, oh, well, this should be fine. She won't break out of here, will she? And the first thing she does, of course, is bust herself right out of this place because she's a perfect being.
But it also raises a question, Stephen, though, if in the theme of the movie, if she's like this perfect being, couldn't she just make the shackles disappear or make her arms, intangible for a moment? Aren't there other godlike things she can do besides kick people in the face and jump out a window?
Well, you'd think, I don't know, because the perfect being, I don't think it necessarily means you have to have supernatural powers if you're a perfect being. It does seem like she would be, you know, a little bit more strapping, a little bit more muscular.
She should be like the female Dr. Manhattan if she's a supreme ultimate being.
No, but see, this is the supreme biological being. Dr. Manhattan is supernatural, you know, like this is it. She's a biological. She still has DNA, which means she's still basically an animal.
Carbon-based, in a way.
Right. And so there's no reason to think that extra DNA would make her. I mean, it clearly, it does things that are plausible that they might do, which is she has super strength despite the fact that she does not have the physique that would necessarily indicate that. She has super intelligence. She's able to pick up English in an afternoon by watching TV at rapid speed.
Like Johnny Five.
She knows, you know, and learned Kung Fu and whatever else. Like, and, you know, so she has things that are sort of plausibly in the realm of if you had super DNA, you might realistically be able to do.
I have a question. It's a science question.
Yep.
We're going to fast forward just a bit, but then we'll come back to yours. Who is Ruby Rod, which is Chris Tucker, who is he broadcasting to?
Everybody. It's a radio host.
They never show it.
Why would they show it?
They never show it once.
Well, who are they going to show it to?
How do you cut away to people listening or watching his show? Movies do it all the time.
Why would you do that? Who cares about that?
You cut away to a stadium watching him. Or you cut away to...
Why?
Because for all we know, he's talking to like 1,000 people on this boat, or we don't like. There's no context for what he's doing. I know
clearly
they tell
he's
us,
a major personality. Like he's broadcasting,
but they don't show
giant
us
radio
that
radio show. I don't. They don't. I don't feel like they need to show us that. Like,
if your point is this guy is the biggest DJ celebrity in the universe, you need to show us that. You can't just have him yelling
they
into
show
a microphone.
Us that by showing everybody how everybody reacts to him.
Oh yeah. Okay. Fair enough. The girls. Yeah. Everyone reacts to him all crazy. You're right. Yeah. You're right. All right. What I'm saying is Richard Dawson from The Running Man should have played Ruby Rod.
we were talking about Zorg's plan and we got off of that.
Yeah.
Zorg's plan makes no sense whatsoever, right? So Zorg is this guy who owns, I guess he owns a big corporation. He does arms dealing and other things, and I don't know. It's not very clear what his main line of business is. But at one point, the priest, of the ancient Egyptian order that knows all of the lore about, played by Bilbo Baggins, the first Bilbo Baggins,
The wonderful Ian Holm from Alien. Thank you.
Right, also from Alien as well, Ash. He goes at one point to see Gary Oldman and asks him like, "What's up? What's your plan?" And Gary Oldman, as a demonstration, drops a glass onto the ground. And then a bunch of robots scurry in and pick it up and sweep it away. And then a new glass appears on his table. And his whole thing is that, like, when you destroy things, that creates opportunities basically for the economy to come in and, you know, creates jobs. It creates busyness of, in this case, it's only robots, so it's not even people. But, you know, that
but somebody
destruction
has to build
breeds,
those robots.
Right. Well, the destruction breeds economic activity.
Yeah.
The problem with this plan is that the master that he's serving, the supreme anti-being, or what, you know, I don't even know if they give it
space glob.
They call him Mr. Shadow. You know, he knows him only as Mr. Shadow, but the giant space blob thing that's pure evil is going to destroy everything,
yep,
including all of the people that would rebuild it and all of the robots that might rebuild it, and like
right,
literally everything, all of life, the entire universe will be destroyed, and there will be nobody left to put it all back together again. So that whole reason for wanting to do it makes no sense. Although you could argue that maybe he's not aware that that's the plan. He just thinks that this guy's going to come and, like, you know,
yes,
mess stuff up on Earth for a little bit, and then he's going to be able to jump in and, like, make money cleaning it up.
Yeah, that's a good point. He could just think he's another nasty client. That's
yeah,
a good point.
Although, generally speaking, nasty clients can't, like, get you on the phone and then make your brain bleed or your scalp bleed or whatever else,
black
but just
goo,
by talking
right
to you. It's like black. No, but it's clearly supposed to be blood because then he rubs it and it's red, but it's, like, black. And it comes from who knows where. Like it happens to Baron Munchausen earlier on in the movie as well. The military guy. Yeah.
John Neville. Yeah. Yeah. It's meant to indicate that he's being like hurt by the being.
Right.
But then that also raises another possibility, Stephen. He's just scared of it. That's it. That's
yeah,
why he's doing it, because he's afraid of it.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, I commend them for not doing like nose bleeding or ears bleeding or eyes bleeding, which have all been done to death. But top of your head bleeding? They don't show where it's coming from because it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Talk about that gun, Steven. How many different power weapons are in that one gun? There's a net. There's like a laser.
So I didn't think about this until this viewing, and I've seen this movie so many times. That gun is sort of the anti-Chekhov's gun because he goes and he shows all these modes that it can do. It's like, oh, you can shoot a net with it. You can shoot, you know, darts. You can – it has the repeat function where you, you know, aim it at one place and fire one shot, and then you can turn around and shoot wherever you want, and the bullets will always go back to that place. And those are all kind of cool ideas, none of which – ever come back. Not a single one of which ever comes back later on in the movie as a thing that, like, oh, Bruce Willis now has this gun and he's going to be able to use it to use this repeat function.
Right. And that's why they showed us
somebody or whatever.
That's like, why they showed us the rockets. Right.
And none of them happened. So in that sense, you're right. That scene is in some sense spinning its wheels a little bit. It is filler.
I just think it's meant to show that, you know, all right, we have a scene where we have to show him selling weaponry to another group. So why not just have fun for a few minutes and show how wacky this gun is?
I like that those guys are shapeshifters.
But your theory is fun too, that like, hey, we'll show all these things and everyone's going to wait for it and then we don't show it. Haha.
Yeah. I mean, it seems, you know, again, like that's one of the basic rules of fiction, and it's literally called Chekhov's gun, which is if you show the gun in act one, you have to use it by act three. And in this case, like, nah, never mind. We're not going to. None of them are, like, even the bad guys aren't going to use them. They're just going to use them as guns. Later on, there's going to be a giant shoot 'em up on the cruise ship, and they're just going to all gonna use them as guns. So then they go through this elaborate plan to get Bruce Willis to Flossed in Paradise, which is this beach resort on some other planet. And in one of the wild coincidences that drives this movie, so Lilu, Mila Jovovich, crashes into Bruce Willis's car. And then Bruce Willis takes her to the priest and says, all right, never mind, I'm done with this whole situation. And then through one of these weird coincidences, it turns out Bruce Willis is an ex-space pilot, basically like a space Navy SEAL kind of is how it's – but also a pilot. And he gets a call from his boss who works for the president saying basically, hey, we pretended to have you win this radio contest so that you can get on this cruise ship right away and take this supreme being over to Flossed in Paradise. Meanwhile, Ian Holm decides that he's going to try to take Bruce Willis's place
All of this stuff where they keep coming up to the desk with the Corbin Dallas. To me, it feels like someone telling a 20-minute joke and having no idea how comedy works.
It's a Shaggy Dog story. I think it's funny. I think it's ridiculous. There's the whole subplot with his mother, who sounds like a 30-year-old person doing a fake Jewish mother accent.
Oh, it's like he's so in love with that joke that it literally ends the movie. They're like, oh, wait, the movie's about to end. Let's make sure we get the yelling mother on the phone again. One thing, wait, but in the middle of trashing everything, you did mention the president. And I will say that Tiny Lister as the president is not only inspired casting, but he's legitimately funny in
the
movie.
He's a terrible actor, though.
Yeah, he's not great with, but he knows how to deliver a funny line. He knows how to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, he's got some good comic chops, but no, his line readings are not convincing.
And even Ian Holm, who I absolutely love, is kind of like bored in this movie. He's just like, oh, I'm the old wizard character? Okay.
Yeah. Well, so they have the old wizard character, but then they give the old wizard character a nervous sidekick character, who also just seems completely unnecessary. But again, to me, this is all of the charm of this movie.
You need him because there are four elements pillars. And like this character who has been in the movie for literally 8 seconds now becomes somewhat integral because we need him for the pillars.
Yeah, he's the one who figures out how to open the elements at the end.
Yeah, a character we've never barely seen before. He becomes integral like an hour and 25 minutes into the movie.
Which, speaking about those, by the way, I didn't realize again until this viewing. So they go, they retrieve these stones from this diva, like a literal diva, like an opera singer with blue skin.
Why? Explain, and I'm not challenging you. If you don't know, then you don't know.
Yeah.
Why are the stones inside of an opera singer, and would they have come out if she didn't get shot?
Well, presumably she has some way to put them in and remove them. I don't know whether they went in an orifice that alien has that we can't see.
Or like a pouch, maybe. Or like a kangaroo pouch.
Or if she's able to be, like, you know, if she's, you know, her biology is such that you can cut her open and stick the stones in and then she just heals over the top of it. I don't know. They never really sort of established that. The why is much easier to understand. It's a decoy. Like, they literally bring a box that looks like it has the stones in it, and it does exactly what it's supposed to do. Gary Oldman shows up and takes this box and thinks, yeah, I got the stones. It's awesome now.
Twice.
And then gets halfway away.
Twice in this movie, conflict would have been avoided if they had opened the box first before bringing it to a second location. Twice!
Yep.
Open it there, stupid!
Yep.
And, but again, that is, you know, that's nitpicky, the comic book, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm getting into the film critic side of it, but doesn't that annoy you just a little when so much care and money and effort and talent went into the visual side, and then the plot and the narrative and the dialogue is like not nearly as much effort went into that?
Well, I will revisit this when we start talking about the next movie. I will presage that by saying, I think that if you took this kind of a thing too seriously, if you didn't turn it up to 14, it would be terrible in an entirely different way.
Fair. I mean, he's made some other wacky sci-fi films that I kind of like, but I don't mind the tone. I don't like the tone of this movie, but I could forgive that if it was more coherent.
That's very similar in a lot of ways to his most recent movie, which was Valerian and the City of 1,000 CGI Effects and Zero Compelling Characters, which doesn't work despite its silliness or whatever else because of the characters at the very heart of it. The lead man and woman have zero chemistry, zero interest whatsoever. And again, to me, at the end of the day, that's what makes a story good or not good to me. Do I identify with the characters? Do I want to go on this journey with them? And if you don't, you don't. Like, I didn't find Flash Gordon a particularly compelling character to want to follow for 2 hours. I did find Mila Jovovich and Bruce Willis infinitely watchable to over 2 hours.
How much better would Flash Gordon be if we replaced Dale Arden with Leeloo?
And Flash Gordon with Bruce Willis?
Well, again, I am a Bruce Willis fan. I can be critical, but I definitely like Bruce Willis. And this seems like a mostly joyless kind of, let me get through this. This is a weird movie. I didn't know what I was signing up for.
No, I disagree. I think he's playing the straight man. I think that he knows he's playing the straight man. Everything around him is completely ridiculous. And so if he were ridiculous or if he were too showy or whatever else, that like, you know, if you put Nicolas Cage in this in that role, like the movie would be completely.
No, you're right. I don't think he's very interesting. I don't think he's very likable. He's just kind of bland.
So I don't know. I like this movie. I know. I get why people would not like it. I couldn't. It's hard for me to explain why I do like it, because it does have all of these elements that our longtime listeners will hear me griping about constantly in a lot of the movies that we watch.
Right, but you know what, man? You just nailed a really key asset to enjoying film, which is it's not like watching a baseball score. Oh, they got 12 hits and 5 runs. The other team got 9 hits and 3 runs, and that's how you measure it. It's not like that. Sometimes a film is so technically impressive, you'll forgive a lot of other mistakes. Or sometimes the story is so honest and touching that you'll forgive a bad performance or two, you know, and it's not always like a metric. And, you know, so you're like, yeah, Scott, half the stuff that you don't like about this movie, I can understand. Half of it, I don't understand. I still love it because it hit me in an emotional way at a certain time in my life. And if I saw this movie tomorrow, I might go, what is this nonsense? I might hate it. But that's not what happened. I saw it when I was 20. And I was dazzled by what I was dazzled by, and flaws and all, I still love it.
To me, that is ultimately all of everything. Like, everything else is icing. Everything else, if it looks beautiful, if it does something new and interesting and bold and whatever else, all of those things, none of those, for me, are substitutes for, do I care about these characters and the journey that they're on? If I do, then all of those things will add to the experience. If I don't, then you can have 5,000 of those things, and it still won't be what I would consider a good movie or a movie that I, you know, love and want to revisit.
Right. And you know, whereas I love and I can totally get why you would want to watch an entire movie or two about Leeloo and Corbin in that world, just every time I started to get into the movie, something would happen that make me go, why? What am I looking at? What? Stop. What does that joke mean? What is he wearing? Why is that so silly? Why is that a fisheye lens? Why is that, you know, like just so much weirdness. And wrapping up on a whole scale, good and bad, I give this movie a C because I am truly impressed by the visual scope of it and a handful of the performances. But beyond that, it's just empty calories for me. And I'm glad that other people love it, but it ain't for me.
I mean, I'll give it a B+. It's certainly not an A movie. It's a movie that, like I said before, I find it infinitely rewatchable. You know, it's a comfort movie. You know, it's like sitting down with a bowl of soup or whatever when you're sick. Like it's the kind of thing that I can just put on and enjoy. But it's not something that, you know, is profound or speaks to me, you know, on a deep level about the human condition. So it's the very definition of a B+, better than average movie. And scientifically, it's an F. I mean, insofar as it needs a grade at all. It's, you know, it's terrible. There's nothing scientific in it that's true, in the same way that Star Wars and Flash Gordon both, I think, I gave Fs to. Scientifically, I don't think it's trying to be accurate, so it doesn't really get any knocks for that. But yeah.
So yeah, all right. So now let's move over to a film that is only slightly more realistic.
That's debatable.
It is the second film by Roland Emmerich, and it was a big hit, which paved the way for Independence Day and many, many more films that Steven loves.
Such as 2012.
Let's talk about Stargate.
I don't hate this movie. I'll begin with that.
If you had asked me a week ago, I'd have said, nah. And having revisited it the other night, I like it a little bit more this time. I think that the setup is so interesting and kind of quick and a little too quick for its own good. I love, the plot basically is scientists discover a circle out in the desert that allows us to travel to a distant planet. And that distant planet indicates that all of humanity started in ancient Egypt by an alien, Ra, the sun god Ra. And that's basically it, right? I think that's it. And and I think that the setup is like really fun, matinee sci-fi stuff. You're really into the, and then once they go into the Stargate, it, not immediately, but it gradually gets less interesting over the next hour. Because it's just like you're dealing with outer space and sci-fi and lofty concepts about, you know, thousands of years and epochs and traveling from star to star. And then the rest of your movie is 17 people running through the desert.
We don't have a running sort of meter for some of these things, but I did want to point out that by my count now, we have covered at least three movies, including these two, that begin with some sort of archaeological dig.
This movie, like our predecessor, also has two prologues.
Right. And so we have a prologue in – it's not in ancient Egypt. It is in the 1920s, I think.
The 10s.
Somewhere in there. And they're on this archaeological dig and they discover the Stargate. And for some reason decide, you know, to throw out all archaeological rules to the wind and haul this thing vertical. Instead of like slowly excavating it from the ground, they get a bunch of people to – grab it with ropes and haul it. Although I guess in the 1910s or 1920s, they were a little more gung ho about just getting things out of the ground as quickly as possible. Nowadays, you know, they attack it with dental picks and toothbrushes and whatnot.
Or they would bombard it with gamma rays to create flesh over top of it.
So they pull this thing out of the ground, and it's got all these symbols around the outside of it, and it spins in some way or another.
And I like all of this makes sense to me, the way that the scientists bring in James Spader, and they're like, they explain the seven, we can get six of the glyphs, but we need the seventh, and how he figures it out. It's not super dense, but it's intelligent enough, and I'm like, all right, I get it.
Go. It is enough, I guess, for the movie.
Go ahead. No, I want, that's why I brought it up.
There are some severe logic holes in this, and these I definitely noticed first time watching this movie. All right, so let's talk about the obvious ones, right? So they know that they need seven symbols, and it's established later in that scene that they know what the first six symbols are because they say, oh, this is the furthest we've ever gotten before. We got all the first six symbols, but we never figured out what the seventh symbol is. There's like 30, 40 symbols on the outside of that thing.
Yup.
So all they needed to do was just try each one of them in turn.
I thought I'm going back to video gamers. When you want to try and open up a combination lock on a game, and you have like 4, 5, 9, but you don't have the fifth number or the fourth number, guess what? You're almost there.
Yeah, exactly. Just try 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6, 1, 2, 3, 7.
Exactly.
Oh, there it is. It's 1, 2, 3, 7. We're done. So like, but in the meantime, he does this whole explanation for what the symbols are, which they didn't understand before. And so that I think is part of the point of that whole scene is to explain what the symbols are, because they think that there's some sort of writing, but it's not ancient Egyptian, and so they don't know what it is. And then he figures out that they're star constellations.
Explain exactly how the Egyptologist matches up the glyph with the constellation.
He happens to see a picture of a constellation in a newspaper.
Right. And if he hadn't seen, if that security guard hadn't been holding up that newspaper at that exact moment, the movie would have ended right there.
Or they would have had to call an astronomer in at some point. Well, so then that brings me to item number two on my list of, you know, what the hell are they thinking? He convinces them. So it looks like they already know what this thing does, despite the fact that they've never actually been able to figure out how it works, right? So like they have this whole apparatus built and people are like, oh, we're operating at 70%. And there's like people are, you know, scientific jargon and rising crescendo of sounds as the thing spins around. And they all act like they know that like this thing is leading, you know, to something profound, which they have no reason to believe whatsoever, I wouldn't think, because like, oh, what if a gate appears in the middle of this? It's not a thing that you think of something you found buried in the ground in ancient Egypt. So like why did they even set this whole place up in the first place?
There is a bunch of, I wouldn't call them miniature plot holes scattered around this whole setup. There is. That, definitely.
So leaving all of that aside for a second, you know, he figures out the last symbol. They, you know, the thing appears in what in 1994 was a very cool effect of the water, you know, looking like it was vertical and the you know, the
Stargate. Oh, it's a great effect. It is. I mean, it's simple. I mean, but it's great. It looks, it still looks cool.
So then you know, they send a robot in at first and the robot doesn't come back or send any information back. So then they decide, okay, well, we're going to send a bunch of Marines in, led by
Kurt Russell.
By Kurt Russell. And
and the craziest crew cut you'll ever see. Oh,
he has two terrible hairstyles in this movie. Because when we first see him, he's got this long...
He's given... You want... Hey, screenwriting? Anybody out there who wants to learn screenwriting? Here you go. In the beginning of the film, he has long hair. He's brooding while holding a gun. And he's staring at a picture of his son. Then these two soldiers come in and say, you're needed for a super secret mission, and then they leave. We get everything from that. His son died somehow, and he is beyond function, okay? We get all of that. But the two soldiers, on the way to the car, there's like all this ADR where it's like, well, what's wrong with him? Oh, his son died. He accidentally shot himself. Oh, man. Yeah. And it's like, why? And then later that pays off because, of course, there is an ancient Egyptian teenager who briefly touches Kurt Russell's assault rifle and he yells at him. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you screenwrite characters.
Well, so one, I mean, that has all the hallmarks of a studio slash test audience interference. They played it for people with just that first scene in and like a third of their test audience was like, I don't understand. Why was he looking at the picture of his son? Why wasn't his son there? Blah, blah, blah. Why is he holding the gun? And, you know, enough people were dense enough to not get it that they decided they needed to add this other scene with the ADR.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They explain it. But
I will take exception with one opinion. I think that Kurt Russell with that long surfer hair at the beginning, pretty cool.
He looks like a teenage surfer stoner.
What's weird, though, is that early in the film, when he first shows up with that, like, blondish, weird crew cut.
That's weird. It, like, sticks out to the sides.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks like the character, like one of the characters from, like, Street Fighter.
Yeah. He's a Bobo. What's interesting about his hair is that he has this weird, bulbous crew cut earlier. As if I'm a movie star and I have to have a hair, I have to have a crew cut, but I'm not getting my hair cut that short. And then later, that in the film, that crew cut is pretty much wilted. It's gone.
They only had enough gel for half the movie. Their gel budget ran out.
And here's the thing: James Spader is given some fun stuff to do. He's like, you know, the nerdy but still adventurous and brave, plucky scientist hero.
Yeah.
And I think Kurt Russell is kind of saddled with just be. Clench your job, Kurt, and that's it. And he's so much more versatile and charming than that, or even tough and mean. He's just, it's just a bland character for this actor.
He's a very bland character. And they expect for this tragic backstory, which even in 1994, trite. Like, okay, come on, dude. And I think we've talked about this before. Like, for me, like, now that I am a parent, the whole, the guy has a dead wife and or dead kids as his tragic backstory just rubs me the wrong way every single time now.
And I'll tell you why. It's lazy shorthand.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, we're not really going to get into the, you know, it's we're talking about a B-movie matinee sci-fi movie here. But it's cheap screenwriting. People go, what's the worst thing that we can tell a parent about this character? Or we could tell a viewer. His kid died last year. Okay, like that's it. That's the shorthand and it's cheap.
Right, and we're not going to grapple with that in any way. We're not going to really actually like explore that as a theme. The movie doesn't grapple with it in any way. It mentions it at the very beginning and then there's no bearing on the plot whatsoever.
Oh, no. It's just meant to show why he's no nonsense and gruff and tough. Right. That's it.
And why he's willing to kill himself at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Because he has nothing left to live for. Which
except the wife.
Who brings a nuclear bomb on a reconnaissance mission?
Yeah. That's where the movie starts to lose me. Okay, they travel in and I'm like, all right, now the premise here is, like I said, that Ra governs all of humanity.
Yeah, so he came and he discovered human beings and decided to enslave them and in the course built pyramids and whatever else.
And wait, but if I'm not mistaken, pyramids, in the context of this movie, they give us the answer. Ready, Stephen? We have the answer for what the Great Pyramids are. Ready? They're alien parking lots.
Basically.
That's where the aliens park their spaceships. Yeah,
they're alien landing
pads.
That's it. Which, scientifically, from a scientific point of view, I'm not an Egyptologist. It's not my area of expertise. I am pretty sure that if the Great Pyramid of Giza was a spaceship, we would have figured that out by now. Oh, but right before that, I was going to say, the other thing that just struck me as being especially odd about this movie and some of the scientific choices that it makes is, so they decide to send Kurt Russell and his Marine team through the Stargate. And James Spader says, basically, you need me because I need to be able to decipher the symbols so that you can figure out how to get back. And they go, okay, sure, that makes sense. Let's bring you there. No, that doesn't make any sense because these symbols, as they establish a little bit earlier, are the constellations, right? And he goes through this whole rigmarole about how, oh, you need 6 points to define a center point and then one more to do a vector. And
well, no, yeah, 6 points make a three-dimensional object and the seventh point is your origin.
Right.
Get it right, doctor.
It's your point of origin. We know what our point of origin is. Anyway.
Right, you have that data, don't you?
Right. They use constellations instead of like individuals. Like that might make sense if you're talking about individual stars, six individual stars, and if you draw lines in between each pairs of stars, you know, it ends up at one point in the center and that's the place where you're going. Like that, there's some maybe truth to that. Like that's a could be a possible way to navigate. It's kind of ridiculous in some ways. The constellations change. They won't have changed in 5,000 years, but they change over timescales. And so where the constellations, what they look like now is not even what they might look like 10,000 years from now. So the Stargate is limiting itself right off the bat. But I guess that makes some sense because the galaxy is moving and so it's self-limiting because you have to go to where the planet is now, as opposed to where it's – anyway.
Did you know, Stephen, I found this out on Wikipedia. Did you know that in 1996, a high school teacher won a lawsuit against Emmerich and Devlin for claiming that they stole his 1984 film script, Egyptscape?
This is one of those things. It's ridiculous.
But he won the lawsuit. You know how hard it is to win one of those?
Well, that means they must have stolen specific elements or he got a very favorable jury because this whole idea of ancient aliens actually helped build civilization, it goes back it goes back a long way, but it was popularized in the 70s by Eric von Daniken in a book called Chariots of the Gods, which I read when I was in high school, which, you know, points to all these old artworks on not just in Egypt, but in South America, in Asia, in a lot of different places.
Safe to say that book is the great granddaddy of the ancient aliens TV show?
Yeah, well, yes, I think so. I think, I think that theory existed prior to that, but that popularized it. That book was a massive hit in the 70s.
Ancient Aliens has now been running for, 14 seasons? And I mean, obviously Chariots of the Gods and, you know, other documentaries are what created this trend. But I think Stargate definitely helped. And then Stargate inspiring, 4 different TV series? I mean, that certainly didn't hurt.
So anyway, this whole idea that like the constellations define a thing. Constellations are just things that kind of happen to look the way they look from Earth because of our line of sight. The stars in a constellation are not actually close to one another in space at all. They take an extent across the sky, which alone is going to make them thousands of light years apart. But then also some of them are close to us and some of them are really, really far away. So like a constellation doesn't define a point in space.
So what you're saying is like the idea of using a constellation as if it's like a point on a map is not feasible?
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
Which is why sailors will talk about the North Star and not necessarily guide me by the Big Dipper.
Right. I mean, like, so I was trying to think of a good analogy for this and I haven't been able to come up with a really good one. But like imagine you were standing at Battery Park, which we've talked about in previous podcasts, at the southern end of the island of Manhattan. And you looked north from Manhattan and you see lots of buildings, right? And some of those buildings are really close and some of them are really, really far away. If you said, okay, find the midpoint between those buildings and the buildings in Chicago.
Right, right. You would need real calculations. You couldn't just estimate.
Well, not just we would need real calculations, but like the very question doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like if you said, oh, what's the distance between like Sears Tower and the Empire State Building? Those are two points on a map.
Gotcha.
But like Manhattan is over a large
extent.
Right,
that's not a precise measurement, right?
Right, it's not a precise measurement at all. So regardless, In order to get back, he needs to be able to decipher the symbols. Now, on one level, obviously, again, that makes no sense because they spend the rest of the movie looking for a tablet that has these symbols on it. And literally anybody could just look at that tablet and go, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now I know what the symbols are.
Yeah, dude, like, it's just kind of a fun movie, but the whole getting back stuff is just nonsense. It's like, dude, lock yourself in a room, Roland and Dean, and figure out a better reason he
You know who might have been able to help them get back?
Who?
An astronomer. Because the entire point of this thing is that you can use the constellations to figure out where the planet is, and then as long as you know your point of origin.
Oh, I get it. You have a grudge against Stargate because all they brought was an Egyptologist and 6 soldiers. They didn't bring an astronomer.
First of all, I was not an astronomer when I first saw this movie. But my point is that, like, if they're going to go to all of this trouble to explain, like, how this, you know, you need the 6 points to define a vector and then a point of origin and whatever else. Like you could theoretically, if you looked at the stars and you knew where Earth was in relation to where you were, you could theoretically backwork all of that stuff and then figure out what the constellations are that it was using. Again, leaving aside for the moment that in itself doesn't make any sense, but if it did make sense, then like you could, you know, an astronomer might be able to actually like do calculations and figure out.
In the realm of this movie, that would make sense, right?
Right. So instead, you know, they bring along the Egyptologist, and his main role in the movie, and the reason why, you know, from a screenwriting perspective, they have him along on the journey, is because he's able to communicate with these people and read the stuff on their versions of the pyramids. So the alien at some point brought a whole bunch of people. People on Earth rebelled against the alien and I guess threw him back through the Stargate or something. Yep. And he decided to bring a bunch of people over and then kept them as slaves and didn't allow them to read or write so that I guess they couldn't develop civilization and ever rebel against him again. So there, you know, there's a whole bunch of basically ancient Egyptians, except that this is now 5,000 years from the building of the pyramids. And so the idea that they would still be speaking the same language.
It's the far generations of the people he kidnapped.
Right. I mean, like, you know, you can go read Shakespeare and you can understand, you know, 90% of what's going on in a Shakespeare play. That was 300 years ago. You definitely can't understand it unless you're a Middle English scholar, you know, Beowulf or any of the older English texts. So the idea that, like, this Egyptian language would have changed so little over the course of 5,000 years on this planet when, like, the actual Egyptian language here on Earth is completely different from ancient Egyptian spoken 5,000 years ago.
Okay.
Their language would have evolved just as much, and it would, you know, it would be no more mutually intelligible than any of the languages that came – that branched off from ancient Egypt 5,000 years ago on Earth.
Right, but does that make more or less sense than the coffin that brings people back to life?
He sleeps in his sarcophagus. Like, is he a vampire? Like, I mean, I guess he kind of is in a way because he sleeps in a sarcophagus and he lives forever. But he does it with technology? I don't know.
This movie focuses on 2 things I don't really love. I don't love the concept of ancient aliens. And I get that this movie is pure nonsense fiction. I know. But my issue is mainly with the pervasiveness of the ancient aliens show, which is kind of tacky if you think about it. The entire premise of the ancient alien theory is that ancient civilizations were not intelligent or crafty enough to do these things because we can't explain them.
Yep.
These people, these savages couldn't possibly do it.
There's a whole lot of racism tied up in that too.
And I think that's it. Yep. Racism or xenophobic, call it whatever you want. But it's bigoted as hell.
Yep.
There are mysteries out there that I can't explain. And I obviously, people who want to entertain the idea that aliens have visited the planet, yeah, it's definitely possible. But man, 15 seasons worth? Good Lord.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about some more astronomy stuff.
Yeah.
So at one point he says, at some point they said, oh, where's the probe? Oh, it's somewhere in the Calliope galaxy. That makes no sense. That makes even less sense than the constellations things because the constellations are all stars that are in our galaxy. So if they were going to define a central point that was between all of those constellations, that point would be within our own galaxy. It would not be in another galaxy someplace else. Again, that's like saying that, like, you know, oh, I'm going to find the center point between the 3 cars in my driveway and it's actually in, you know, San Francisco, even though I live in Austin. Like, that doesn't – like, what? No, that doesn't make any sense.
You know, if you're going to throw out science points, I'm going to throw out narrative points too.
Okay.
Here's one issue that I have with the movie. It's not just that it's pretty fanciful sci-fi and then it gets stuck in a desert. It also taps into this theme that was very prevalent in the 90s, which is somebody, usually a white guy, shows up to help some backwoods or backwater or oppressed people fight back against their oppressors. It's always been a template story. It's always been an iconic story. But in the mid-90s, it was everywhere.
The white savior.
And off the top of my head, I can only think of No Escape starring Ray Liotta.
Oh, well, Dances with Wolves, The Last Samurai.
Yes, thank you, thank you, yes.
I mean, the white savior trope is very, you know, even Lawrence of Arabia, that's exactly what it is.
Yep, and the thing that bugs me a little bit about this movie is that they have these completely indistinguishable side soldier characters who go with Russell and Spader to the planet, to the sand world.
And one of them is played by French Stewart. One of them is played by a guy who I swore was Dave Matthews for the entire time I was watching.
I think one is John Deal, the great character actor.
if I'm watching this
in a rough cut and they say, Scott, what's your advice? I'd be like, punch up everything with those soldiers. Make them like the guys and girl. First of all, make one of them a woman at least. And make them funny or selfish or scared. They're so bland. And like those characters matter. Like those third, fourth, fifth, sixth characters, they matter. And they're so dull. And it's not the actors, it's the writing.
Yeah. Which again, say what you will about Fifth Element, and you may not actually like the characters because you think they're over the top. Like there was certainly no shortage of big, bold characters in that movie and no danger of mixing almost any of them up with any of the other ones.
Yeah, I remember they keep cutting back to this B or C story with the soldiers. And I'm like, man, if these guys were like Hicks and Hudson and Vasquez, that I'd be into. But these guys are just dull. Let's talk about Jay Davidson as Ra.
Yeah.
Creepy. You know, I get a little bored watching like the little Egyptian kids staring at the Egyptian looking gods. And I'm like, enough with this. I thought this was a sci-fi movie and not a period piece. But when he takes off the mask and he's just delivering his either in fake Egyptian or in English, he's intimidating. It's a good performance. Yeah. And you would think for a movie like this, they'd get a big hulking tough guy.
Right.
But no, he's insidious and quiet. He's creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we talk about the alien design? Because they show the aliens a couple of times and they look almost identical, if not actually identical, to the Greys from Fire in the Sky. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, of course are based on this, you know, long history of iconography of aliens.
Oh, and once we figure it out, we are going to do that movie. Once we figure out what to pair it up with. Fire in the Sky is a good movie.
One of the scariest science fiction movies ever made. So my biggest scientific gripe in this movie, I tweeted out a picture via the Science vs. Fiction Twitter account of when they first arrive on the planet, you know, they come out the entrance of this pyramid, they all turn around and they look up and they realize, oh no, we really are on another alien planet, because when we look at the pyramid, we see what behind it?
Three moons.
Well, so there's the rub. They don't see three moons. They see three objects in the sky. Those three objects, if you look at them, and everybody should go to our Twitter and look at this picture, they are identical to one another. They're just rotated. So they're three moons that have all of the same markings, craters, seas. They're all identical to one another, except they're rotated in different orientations. And if you go and you Google a picture of the actual moon, you will see that they're all just our moon. So they basically just like clone stamped our moon in three different places in the sky.
So they took a photo of our moon three times, rotated them and stuck them up
and
there.
And stuck them in a different, slightly different sizes. Like they couldn't even do the bare, like how hard is it to hire an artist to just draw three different moons? Like they literally are just our moon, three places in the sky.
Did you notice the very early appearance of a character actor we know and love going here by his first name, Jaiman Hansu? As I believe Horus?
No, I saw his name in the credits, but then I didn't actually. Is he one of the bad
guys? Yeah,
he's
Horus. He's one of Ra's henchmen, and he is a.
I hadn't made that connect. Like again, I saw his name in the credits, but I didn't even think about it because he's under that mask most of the time, and then he's got makeup on. Which, why are they wearing makeup on underneath the masks?
Yeah, I know that seems ill advised. And I also do like, although he's just, you know, the typical tribal wise man, character actor Eric Avari, who
you've
seen him in 100 different things. And he does more with his eyes and the tone of his voice than most actors can do with a full English dialogue. He's a fantastic actor.
No, he's really, really good. I like him a lot. And one of the things that this movie does get right that I definitely appreciate is that they don't arrive on this alien planet and everybody just speaks English. You know, looking at you, Flash Gordon, you know, and a million other sci-fi movies, John Carter of Mars.
Gordon's alive.
Planet of the Apes.
I mean, there are parts of Mississippi and Texas where I wouldn't be understood.
So, yeah. So, you know, one of the things I don't like about the way that they portray these
slaves,
the slave characters,
the natives of, kidnapped Egyptian,
right.
The progeny of the ancient kidnapped Egyptians.
Yes. One of the things that, you know, again, with this whole white savior thing and this whole like, oh, well, they're just kind of ignorant savages. At one point, one of them gets a hold of James Spader's lighter. Is it James Spader's? Somebody's lighter. He's playing with
Kurt Russell has a lighter.
Yeah. It was a Kurt Russell. So he gets a hold of Kurt Russell's Zippo and he flicks it and makes fire and everybody's like, oh, and they back away. And that's kind of understandable. Like, you know, fire just appearing out of nowhere is kind of spooky if you don't understand the technology. But then one of the guys goes and he reaches his hand over the lighter like he doesn't know what it is, and then it burns him and he pulls his hand away and he's like, ah. And it's like, though they lit that scene with torches along the walls. Like, all we've seen, the only lighting we've seen that these people have is, they clearly understand fire. Ancient Egyptians understood fire.
Maybe he didn't know if it was real. He wanted to make sure it was real fire. Maybe he thought it was
hologram. Looks like fire. Like, but in that case, you wouldn't be surprised when it burned. You'd be like, oh yeah, no, it is real fire. Like, but he, the way he reacts, it makes it look like he wasn't expecting it to burn him.
No, you're right. That is the reaction of someone who's never, ever seen fire before.
Right. And again, it's just a way to sort of paint these guys as rubes.
Right. Plus, it's just not that interesting of a plot. It almost feels like, hey, we came up with this really cool setup and device to get us to another planet, and we even found this cool hook that connects us to ancient Egypt.
Right.
And then what? Like you said, dancing with wolves. Like, go ahead. You know, like, that's the rest of the movie. It's just not that interesting.
I think it is, in a lot of ways, it's influenced by something like John Carter.
Yeah.
Or Princess of Mars, as the book's called. So I have one other, like, big plot hole point that I didn't understand. So at one point, you know, in the middle of the movie, James Spader is worshipped kind of as a god-ish kind of person, or they think that Ra sent him, and so they're being super nice to all these people. They bring him to this tent, they wash him, these old women wash him, and they bring this slave girl to him, which, you know, there's a whole ickiness with that I won't get into. But the slave girl eventually—
Whoa, Steven, he immediately turns down her sexual advances.
He does, but then later on in the movie, he kisses her.
Yeah.
And problematic.
No, but you always have that. I mean, I probably hasn't been that many times, but I feel like I've seen that sequence where the noble hero tries to turn down the sexual advances of the young woman, and it offends somebody. The father or the tribal elder is now offended.
Yep.
You know, it's like it's her fault.
Yep.
And it's like, all right, you know what? I'm not pointing any fingers here, but I'm glad like these cliches are dying out because it's ugly.
Yeah. No. And then, but then by the end of the movie, you know, she's still a slave. She's still somebody that was given to him as a gift, as if she were property. And so, like, when he kisses her at the end of the movie, it's kind of not any less gross, even though they have had some moments of sort of bonding. She still is not in any way free to say no to him. So, like.
No, but he did throw her in the resurrection coffin and bring her back from the dead, literally. And
I believe that happens after that.
One kiss just for that?
No, I'm pretty sure that happens after he kisses her. I could be wrong.
Oh, fair enough.
I may be wrong.
That is Mili Avital as Shauri. And she is the daughter of the Eric Avari character and quite charming and very beautiful. We've seen her in other things as well.
So she brings him to the pyramid, or she brings him someplace that I was never clear on where it was that she brings him. It's not the same period where they came in on the Stargate. It's some other place. But in this place, you know, we learn the story of the alien because it's all written on these walls. And he can read them because he can read hieroglyphics. Well, so these people can't write. We've established that, right? The people that are actually the slaves on the planet cannot write, read or write. So they did not put these markings in the pyramid. Who did? Like, who wrote this story on the wall?
I mean, it might have been like Ra's, like, bored guards.
Decided to, like, put a bunch of really, really difficult, like, carvings onto walls of a pyramid in order to explain exactly what happened. My point being that if this happened on Earth in Egypt before the invention, or after the invention of Egyptian writing, we would have presumably learned of this from a pyramid on Earth at some point, right?
Right, but isn't that one of the key implications, is that, like, there may be clues about ancient alien visitors hidden in hieroglyphics? Like,
there wouldn't be clues. The point is that these people rose up in rebellion against Ra, banished him to this other place, and then wrote nothing whatsoever about it, or decided to be cryptic about it on the walls of their temples?
Right, because he clearly didn't kidnap everyone, because then there'd be no ancient Egyptians.
Right, then there would be no middle period of Egypt.
Like, right.
We know that Egyptian civilization has been pretty much continuous since then until now, because we have archaeology for all of it. But at no point was this actually recorded in any sort of ancient Egyptian temple.
Did any of the violence – it seemed a little brutal – for like a PG-13 of mid-90s. A lot of carnage in this movie.
I mean, they don't show very much of it.
I know.
They machine guns a bunch of people to death, but it's bloodless. And
they are, of course, the advanced alien technology, the staff zappers, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Those just zap you.
I mean, so I have one more science point that I want to bring up before I wrap up completely. The final act is centered around this idea that Kurt Russell brought this nuclear bomb. Although I don't think they ever actually call it a nuclear bomb. They just call it a bomb. It's implied, I guess, that it's a nuke because it's small. And you can't – the only way that bomb that small could be powerful enough to be dangerous is if it were nuclear. But, you know, they have this bomb and Rod decides that he's going to – in order to stop people from going back through the Stargate again, for some reason, it doesn't just destroy the Stargate on his side, because that seems like it would be the easiest way to stop people from coming back through your Stargate. Yep. But he decides he's going to send the bomb back through the Stargate and blow up all life on Earth. I don't know, blow up their – it's not entirely clear what his plan is, because he doesn't just send the bomb back. He actually waits an appreciable amount of time when he could have just been sending the bomb back in order to get this delivery of this special element that they're mining, which is why they're slaves on this planet in the first place, that will amplify the power of the bomb by 100 times. And this is supposed to be like make it like much, much scarier or raise the stakes in some way. But like if this thing was a nuclear bomb, then making it 100 times more powerful – would just make it a more powerful nuclear bomb. Like, nuclear bombs have a very wide range of power,
right,
and something
right.
that it's, small.
Yo, Steven, this gun won't just kill you. It'll kill you five right. times.
You know, so the bomb dropped on Hiroshima was about 15 kilotons. So 100 times that would be 1,500 kilotons, which is like 1.5 megatons. The largest bomb ever exploded was a test bomb that the Russians did called Tsar Bomba, which was 50 megatons, which is about 3,000 times as powerful as probably that little nuclear bomb is. And it killed nobody because, you know, so like if you sent a bomb back through the Stargate, it would, you know, whatever city they were in might be in some pretty bad trouble, but it wouldn't spread beyond that even if you made it 100 times more powerful. So if the point is just to destroy the Stargate, all you need is the tiny bomb. If the point is to destroy everybody, you need a whole lot more than 100 times power.
If the goal is to destroy the Stargate, all you need is a crowbar.
I mean, really, right? Maybe, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he needs the Stargate because places other than Earth he might want to travel to. And so he needs the Stargate to be able to go. And I could already see people like, you know, getting to us on Twitter at this point going like, oh, well, if you watch Stargate Atlantis, episode 305 says blah, 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 blah. I will say that I have literally never seen a single episode of any of the television shows, so I'm sure there's lore in this that I'm missing entirely.
I want to say the first two, three, maybe four seasons of SG-1 and dug it. It's a good show. It is fun. Good episodic, occasionally has like, you know, connecting stories, but a good cast. I dug it. I think I dig SG-1 even more than the movie. How about that?
There you go.
Let's talk about the story logic of them bringing the bomb. And that is that, all right, we are sending six soldiers and an Egyptologist, no medical doctor, no astronomer,
right.
Nobody who is maybe trained in protocol, trained as an ambassador. Yeah. How about that? You know, like to work with the Egyptologist. No. Six soldiers and an Egyptologist. And they bring a nuclear bomb. They bring a nuclear bomb.
Right.
And the point of that is that if they're unfriendly or we suspect that maybe they'll invade us through their gate,
right,
we bomb them from their side. But like you said,
right,
you wouldn't have to do that. All you'd have to do is break yours in half.
Well, and James Spader says as much to Kurt Russell towards the end of the movie. He's like, all we would need to do is destroy our Stargate. And I guess the point is if they couldn't make it back through the Stargate.
Right.
Because James Spader wasn't able to figure it out, then they have a way to, you know. But again, you don't need a nuclear bomb to do that.
Right.
All you need is a hand grenade, like a shape charge.
Yep.
So,
But obviously, we're talking about stakes here. And, stakes are this dude brought a bomb, son of a bitch, you know. And I also don't like how they waffle with their Kurt Russell character. Has he morally bankrupt now, or is he not? Which is it?
Yeah. I mean, his character, they throw in this tragic backstory and then they kind of try to tie it in later on. And like, that character's a mess. It's a mess. It bears the hallmarks in some ways of like, obviously James Spader is the protagonist of this movie. And, you know, Kurt Russell is a secondary character, but Kurt Russell doesn't play a secondary character. So, like, it almost makes some sense that, like, they cast Kurt Russell and Kurt Russell was like, no, you need to make my character a little bit more. You need to beef up my character a little bit.
We got to add some bookends here and whatnot. Right, right, right.
Yeah, so then, you know, it zips along. It's a perfectly enjoyable movie. It's a Saturday matinee. It's not doing much more. You know, it's not a good movie. It's not a bad movie. Like, I didn't dislike it. I didn't, like... It has these major plot holes, and for some reason they don't bother me nearly as much as I would expect them to, because the movie's amiable enough. I think, you know, again, I think getting back to our earlier discussion, I like James Spader. Like, I like his character.
Yep.
I like him well enough that even though I don't like Kurt Russell's character, you know, I like him. I like the supporting actors that he meets once they get to Egypt. I like the supporting actors even before then. I love the old woman scientist. I think it's great in the very limited screen time that she has.
Vivica Lindfors. Isn't that a great name? It's a fun matinee thing, and I think Roland Emmerich knew how much Spielberg DNA to throw into his movies, you know, because he likes disaster and he likes things a little bit darker than Spielberg does, but he also knows when to sprinkle in the G wonder and the wow, look at this giant spaceship, and you know, like the awe, you know, the gee whiz moments. Yeah. So I think I like it a bit more than I used to. I would give Stargate on the whole a B-. B-. Yeah, it's a B-.
I mean, I'll give it a C. And I will say this about the scientific side of things. And I presaged this when we were talking about Fifth Element. The Fifth Element is well aware of how dumb it is, especially on the scientific scale, right? It makes no pretension to being like, okay, any of this has any real logical sense. Certainly not any scientific sense. It's, you know, it's a fun, dumb space adventure kind of thing. Stargate, it doesn't feel like it knows how silly it is on that scale.
Yeah.
Like, it has a little bit of humor in it, but it doesn't feel like it really, like... certainly not on the scientific, like it takes all the scientific stuff deadly serious and it, you know, introduces it in such a way that like we're meant to be like, oh yeah, no, that's totally
no,
true.
You're right. It does. It's not deadly serious about itself, but yeah, it should, if it did have a better sense of humor, I think it would be a better movie. Good point.
Right. And so for me, like, you know, the Fifth Element is like, you know, you walk up to a little kid and ask them what the gravitational constant is. And they're like, well, I don't know, who cares? Let's build a pillow fort and pretend we're being attacked by Indians, you know? And Stargate is, you know, more like one of those dudes on Facebook who like jumps into an argument and pretends they're an expert because they read an article about it once. And they keep using big words in all the wrong ways to try to sound smart. And it just makes them look dumber. And so that to me is the difference. Like, you know, if you try to look smart but sound dumb, it's harder to take something seriously than something that's just like, don't take me seriously at all from the very, very beginning. And so, you know, on scientific intelligence, I'd give it a D-. It's a little bit better than Fifth Element just because it recognizes that, like, constellations exist. but I came very close to giving it an F, but I decided I just wanted to give Fs all the time.
You're just not willing to forgive that three moonshot.
Well, I was just thinking about that now and going, you know what, maybe I should knock it down to an F. Because what, like, three moons that look exactly like our moon? Come on, guys, that's just lazy.
And it's an otherwise pretty impressive, I mean, it still is an impressive shot, but once you notice that, you're like, why? Yeah,
no, I noticed immediately that they looked all the same. And I, you know, as an astronomer, somebody that used to run star parties, I probably have a better idea of what the moon looks like than the average person. So I like noticed immediately that they were all the same. And then I was like, wait a second. And they all look like the actual moon. And so I Googled a picture of the moon and sure enough, yep, they are. They're all just the moon. Copy and pasted three times in the sky. So yeah, you know what? I'm going to knock him down to an F.
There you go. That's the logic. He is a certified educator, by the way. He has taught students in the past and will in the future. We want to thank you for listening to Science vs. Fiction. This is now episode 19, so look into our backlog and see if you find another couple episodes you like. Please spread the word if you like the show and visit our Patreon. That's patreon.com/ScottEWeinberg if you want to support the show with a few bucks a month. And I want to thank Steven, who we don't mention it on the show, but Steven does all of the editing. And you think, oh, it's two people talking. How hard could that be? Well, it usually takes about three times longer than it is to listen to it. So thank you, Steven, for producing and editing all the episodes.
Yeah, and thank you guys for listening and making it worthwhile.